The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro, Part 2, continued on Cassette Number 3, Side 1. The young men at the Dodge saw the ambition expressed in other ways as well. The Texas State Society, composed of all Texans in Washington, held monthly dances in various hotels. At these dances, young men danced mostly with young women, but not Lyndon Johnson. He danced almost exclusively with older women. I don't remember his ever taking a girl to a dance, but he would dance with all the wives of all the congressmen and cabinet officers, Brown recalls. Even the adoring Latimer felt he knew why. Because the wives would introduce him to their husbands, he says. Other aides held the same opinion. Brown recalls standing with a group of friends from the Dodge and watching Lyndon dancing, and one of them saying, "Do you notice he ignores the young, pretty, single women? He's dancing with all the wives." Another said, "Lyndon's campaigning for something." And a third chimed in, "He never quits campaigning. He's always campaigning." The young men commented to each other on remarks he made. Once one of his three assistants drafted for his signature a letter to Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau, Jr., on behalf of a constituent. The salutation in the draft was, "Dear Henry," and Johnson crossed it out, writing, "Dear Mr. Secretary," in its place, saying, "Look, I can't call him Henry." There was a pause, and then Lyndon Johnson added, "There's going to come a day when I will, but it's not now." And Brown recalls that once, after Johnson had been introduced to someone as an assistant to Congressman Clayburgh, he kind of objected to being classified as an assistant because he said, "I'm not the assistant type, I'm the executive type." Ambition was not uncommon among those bright young men in the Dodge, but they felt that Johnson's was uncommon, in the degree to which it was unencumbered by even the slightest excess weight of ideology, of philosophy, of principles, of beliefs. "There's nothing wrong with being pragmatic," a fellow secretary says. Hell, a lot of us were pragmatic. "But you had to believe in something. Lyndon Johnson believed in nothing, nothing but his own ambition. Everything he did, everything, was for his ambition." A saying about Johnson had gained wide currency among these young men because they felt it described him accurately. "Lyndon goes which way the wind blows." To those closest to him, the three assistants who worked in the same office, the statement that Lyndon Johnson believed in nothing is an oversimplification, and not merely because during the discussions with the Roy Miller clique, which they could overhear, their chief was always as conservative as ever. Lyndon Johnson, they feel, did possess beliefs, quite conservative beliefs. His earliest orientation, Brown says, was on the conservative side. Says Jones, "Intrinsically, he was conservative. But they feel the crucial point is that this statement has no relevance in any discussion of Johnson's career." Having spent years in close proximity to Johnson, they are certain that any beliefs of his, regardless of what they may have been, would have not the slightest influence on his actions. "In his actions," Jones says, "I don't think Lyndon was either a conservative or a liberal. I think he was whatever he felt like he needed to be. Winning is the name of the game. I have no doubt that he could have become either an ultra-liberal or an ultra-conservative, if that would have brought victory. Now that suggests hypocrisy, doesn't it? But, well, winning is the name of the game." "Lyndon was a trimmer," he says. "He would be guided by no philosophy or ideals. He would trim his sails to every wind." Soon there was symbolic proof of this. During the 1933 redistricting, San Antonio, Bexar County, and its 240,000 inhabitants had been split off from the 14th Congressional District and placed in a new 20th District. In 1934, it would elect its own congressman. One of the candidates had been impressed during a visit to Washington by Clayburgh's very efficient secretary, with his ready entree into all the government departments. Upon his return to Texas, he told reporters that Lyndon B. Johnson is considered to be the brightest secretary in Washington. He asked Johnson to work for him during the 1934 Democratic primary, which would be held during Congress's summer recess. Johnson, with Clayburgh unopposed in the primary, agreed. although the candidate was Maury Maverick, the fiery radical whose utopian schemes and fierce defense of communist organizers in Texas had already caused an opponent to charge him with a desire to supplant the American flag with the red flag of Russia. Sam Johnson was very proud at praise for his son from such a source, mailing him a newspaper clipping containing Maverick's quote. He wrote on it, "Breaking into front page space, mighty fine and worthy of it all. Them's my sentiments, Sam." Arriving in San Antonio with Latimer and Jones in tow, he had persuaded the genial Clayburgh to donate all three of them to the Maverick campaign. Johnson put them to work mailing out brochures. He himself began writing them. Maverick saw that this young secretary understood without being told what many politicians never understand, that voters' reluctance to do extensive reading makes simplicity the key to successful political prose. As the worried opponent, San Antonio's corrupt and long-entrenched city machine, stepped up its advertising, Maverick asked Johnson for help writing his own advertising as well as his speeches. Soon Johnson was not only a writer but an advisor, one of Maverick's inner circle. The significant thing was, and you could see this very clearly, that the older men trusted him, Jones says. And he was a campaigner as well, a campaigner whose very unusual ability to meet and greet the public was as effective in San Antonio's teeming Mexican-American ghettos as in the isolated little towns of the Hill Country. The abrazo, or embrace, was a key element in campaigning among Mexican-Americans, and Lyndon Johnson had always been addicted to hugging and kissing. Towering above swarthy men in bright-colored shirts and old women in black rebosos, the tall, skinny, pale young man with big ears and long arms was a conspicuous figure as he abrazoed his way enthusiastically through the crowded, pushcart-jammed San Antonio slums. Maverick won the June primary, but not by the requisite plurality, so a second primary in August was required. Johnson spent most of the intervening 2 months handling Clayburgh's affairs in Corpus Christi, but on weekends he would race back to San Antonio. During the summer of 1934, therefore, Lyndon Johnson was working simultaneously for one of the most reactionary members of Congress, and for a man who would, immediately upon his arrival on Capitol Hill a few months later, be one of the most radical. The 1934 Maverick campaign also marked Lyndon Johnson's first involvement with one of the more pragmatic aspects of politics. Awakening early one morning a day or two before the election, in the big room in San Antonio's Plaza Hotel that he shared with Johnson, Ellie Jones experienced an awakening of another sort. Johnson was sitting at a table in the center of the room, and on the table were stacks of $5 bills. "That big table was just covered with money, more money than I'd ever seen," Jones says. Jones never learned who had given the cash to Johnson. So secretive was his boss that he had not even known Johnson had it. But he saw what Johnson did with it. Mexican-American men would come into the room one at a time. Each would tell Johnson a number. Some, unable to speak English, would indicate the number by holding up fingers. And Johnson would count out that number of $5 bills and hand them to him. It was $5 a vote, Jones realized. Lyndon was checking each name against lists someone had furnished him with. These Latin people would come in, show how many eligible voters they had in the family, and Lyndon would pay them $5 a vote. Everything was for his ambition. Elective office, Johnson was starting to say now, was what he wanted. "You've got to be your own man if you're going to amount to anything," he told Russell Brown. He knew which elective office he wanted. Once, Brown recalls, he was talking about somebody who had run to succeed his boss, and he said that's the route to follow. A few adjustments began to be made in the physical arrangement of Suite 1322. In most congressional offices, the senior aide placed his desk as far as possible from the front door, so that subordinates would handle, and shield him from, casual visitors, who would be mainly tourists from the district. Now Johnson moved his desk immediately inside the entrance door, so that, in Latimer's words, no visitor could possibly advance further without his interception. In part, Latimer says with his wry, knowing grin, the purpose of the shift was to keep the typewriters humming. If anyone talked to Ellie or me, we'd have to stop typing, and that typing was supposed never to stop. But Latimer began to suspect there were other reasons as well. Johnson did not want to be shielded from visitors from the district. Visitors were voters. The new position of his desk ensured that he met voters. A favor routinely bestowed by congressmen's offices, passes to House and Senate galleries, frequently impressed visitors and made them grateful. Johnson wanted visitors, voters, to receive that favor from him, and the position of his desk ensured that they would. The casual visitor who just happened to be in town was weeded out by Johnson, who talked with him 30 seconds and had him out of the office and on his way in another 30, happily clutching his passes, Latimer says. All the while, the typewriters never lost a beat. Sometimes, moreover, a casual visitor would turn out to be what Latimer calls an important person back home. The chief would steer him into Mr. Clayburgh's vacant private office, sit down behind the congressman's desk, chat with him, ask if there was any favor he could do for him, strike up a friendship, which would be cemented a few days later by a buttering-up letter from Latimer. Noticing that such private audiences were held not only with important persons, but with any visitor who happened to mention an interesting piece of district political gossip, Latimer felt there was still another reason for the change in the position of Lyndon Johnson's desk. He didn't want anything concerning his district, no matter how small, going on without him knowing about it. Positioning himself right at the door was Johnson's best defense against such a contingency, Latimer understood. This defense contained one loophole. Each of the two rooms in a congressional suite had its own door to the corridor outside, and in the casual atmosphere of the 1930s, those doors were both generally kept unlocked. Visitors, particularly knowledgeable late-afternoon visitors who were aware which door led to Clayburgh's private office, and who wanted to see the congressman without being cleared by his staff, were therefore able simply to walk in that door, knowing they would receive his invariably pleasant welcome. Now that loophole was closed. Johnson locked his boss's door, and kept it locked. Clayburgh never objected to this new development. He may not have noticed it. He customarily entered and left the two-room suite through the anteroom so that he could chat with his staff. If he did notice it, he did not understand its significance. But Latimer understood. Johnson did not want even his boss doing anything without him knowing about it. He didn't want anyone to see Mr. Clayburgh without going through him first. He didn't want anyone seeing Clayburgh that he didn't know about. Locking Clayburgh's door was an effective device to prevent that. Another effect of this device was, in a small but not insignificant way, since a visitor knowledgeable enough to know the right door was probably an important visitor, to isolate the congressman from his district, to give a tighter hold on it, at his expense, to his secretary. Latimer and Jones began to notice some other changes. Johnson had always been so diligent in grabbing for his boss the credit for federal projects, a PWA sewer or a CCC camp in the district. Now he still grabbed the credit, still raced for Western Union and got the wire off to the mayor of the lucky town before Senator Connolly or Senator Shepard, but not always for his boss. More and more now, the releases he dictated began. Congressman Clayburgh's secretary, Lyndon B. Johnson, announced yesterday that, as was of course the custom in all congressional offices, letters advising individuals that they had received federal favors, pensions, visas, private bills, had always gone out over the congressman's signature to ensure that the gratitude was directed to him. Now the letters being mailed out of his office were beginning to have a different signature, as well as a different opening phrase. In the congressman's absence, I am advising you. And more of a certain portion of the district's business, its political business, was no longer transacted by letter. In Clayburgh country, all chairmen of county Democratic organizations have been Clayburgh men, personal friends of Dick and his relatives, or men economically enthralled to the King Ranch, either as employees of ranch-controlled enterprises or as businessmen dependent on its favor. Persuading Clayburgh that a tighter organization was needed in the district, not much persuading was needed, says Latimer. Anything the chief wanted, Mr. Dick would just say, sure, go ahead, he didn't care. Johnson began to tour its 19 counties. 9 rural counties, most in Clayburgh country, had been added to replace Bexar. in a new car that he had persuaded Clayburgh to buy, and to which Johnson possessed the only set of keys. An expensive Ford Roadster with big balloon tires and seat covers of steer hide, stitched together in the King Ranch saddle shop to display the ranch's famed Running W brand that was South Texas's ultimate status symbol. Driving into sleepy cow towns in that car, dressed in an expensive blue suit, he must have made quite an impression, Latimer says. He met the Democratic leaders, but he also met other leaders, the local banker, the local lawyer, the editor of the local weekly newspaper, the farmer who, his sharp eyes observed, was the man other farmers listened to at meetings of the local Grange or the county AAA Crop Control Committee. Upon his return to Washington, he asked county chairmen to send in regular reports on local political conditions. Those chairmen who responded found themselves in correspondence with Johnson, who replied to their letters the day they were received and asked for another letter in return. Failure of a chairman to respond regularly was the excuse Johnson needed to have a co-chairman appointed. These co-chairmen were not Clayburgh men, but men with whom Johnson had, during his tour, established a personal rapport. He made certain, moreover, that each of these new appointees understood that he owed his appointment not to Clayburgh, but to him. In communicating with these men, he used the telephone. The office's telephone bills had always been enormous by congressional standards. They were paid not out of the meager congressional telephone allowance, but by the King Ranch. But now, each month when Latimer opened the bill, the list of long-distance calls to Texas grew longer and longer. One explanation for Johnson's increased use of the telephone was his desire for secrecy. The door between Clayburgh's private office and the staff's anteroom had always been open. Now, more and more, it was closed. For when the private office was vacant, Johnson would go into it to telephone and shut the door behind him for hours at a time. When he was forced by Clayburgh's presence, or more likely Roy Miller's, to use his own telephone in the anteroom, he would often cup his hand around the mouthpiece to prevent Latimer and Jones from overhearing his words. Other clues about these conversations were also kept to a minimum. In the past, Johnson's invariable practice during telephone calls had been to jot down lists of things to be done as a result of the call, so that Latimer and Jones could do them. Now, on these calls made with his hand, shielding the mouthpiece, nothing was put in writing. Once we had known just about everything that was going on in the district, Latimer says, then we started to realize that there was starting to be a lot going on that we didn't know about. Latimer began to wonder whether use of the telephone was providing Johnson with an advantage beyond secrecy. From the few words he overheard, he knew that the telephone calls to these new friends in the district often concerned favors, including the obtaining of federal patronage jobs, that Johnson was doing for them. Written communications, press releases, and letters were more and more bearing Johnson's name as well as Clayburgh's. In these oral communications, Latimer wondered, was one of those names being omitted entirely? In a letter, Latimer says, Johnson would have to sign the congressman's name, or even if he signed his own name, he would have to make clear that he was only acting for his boss. The letter would have to say, at the congressman's suggestion, I am doing such and such. It might have been dangerous for him otherwise, but on the telephone it was him, Lyndon Johnson, speaking, not Dick Clayburgh. Latimer had, in fact, discerned an overall pattern in his chief's behavior. Before, he had been making friends for Mr. Dick. Now he was making friends for himself instead. A Johnson-arranged boat trip also fit into this pattern. He persuaded Clayburgh that a group of district leaders, in Corpus Christi for an American Legion convention, should have a day's outing on his big cabin cruiser. Foreseeing a boring day, Clayburgh was more willing to give his boat than himself. And Johnson's urgings that Clayburgh should come along were quite noticeably pro forma, which made them predictably unsuccessful. Wright Patman, one of the guests, recalls that on the wonderful outing on Dick Clayburgh's big boat, not Clayburgh but Johnson was the host when we came on board, and he impressed everyone. Lyndon Johnson was using his boss's boat, his boss's car, to pay the enormous telephone bills, his boss's money, to make friends. But he was making friends not for his boss, but for himself. A new political organization was being created in the district, an organization which was coming more and more to be centered not on the district's congressman, but on the congressman's secretary. The purpose of Johnson's creation was not to take Clayburgh's seat away from him. There was not the slightest chance of anyone defeating a Clayburgh in Clayburgh country, but to place him in position to take the seat should it become vacant. And he was working to make it become vacant. The minimum age at which a person could become a congressman was 25, and Johnson would become 25 on August 27, 1933. During that year, a quiet movement began to float the name of Richard M. Clayburgh for the post of ambassador to Mexico. Leaks were planted in Texas newspapers. One went out on the Associated Press National Wire. No one was quite sure who was planting them. There began to be some talk about the possibility in Washington. No one was quite sure who had started it. The Texas State Senate even passed a resolution formally proposing him for the post. The introducer of that resolution was State Senator Welly Hopkins. Clayburgh loved the idea. He had little interest in being a congressman, and, he often said, of all the cities he had ever visited, Mexico City was his favorite. For a while, Miller and other Texas insiders thought he was going to get the ambassadorship. He didn't. It went instead to Josephus Daniels. But periodically thereafter, whenever any hint was received in Washington that Daniels was tired of the post, the quiet push for Clayburgh would begin again. Having determined the route he wanted to follow, Johnson was paving it. But was he also paving a longer one? One that only he saw? One that he, who talked so much, never talked about at all? Since he was not a resident of the adjoining 20th Congressional District, in which Maury Maverick had won election, he was not planning to run for one of that district's elective offices. But his interest in the 20th District did not cease with Maverick's election. The key appointive post in that district was the San Antonio Postmastership, which controlled 600 Postal Service jobs. Since the incumbent postmaster's four-year term was to expire during 1934, before Maverick took office, under the gentleman's contract, which Johnson had devised earlier that year, Clayburgh, as the area's former congressman, had the right to name the new postmaster. Clayburgh didn't care about the successor's identity, Russell Brown says, but Johnson cared. He had his postmaster all picked out, in fact. Dan Quill, a tough young Tammany-type Texan from the San Antonio stockyards, and a power in the city's labor circles. You see Dan Quill, and you see 5,000 votes, Latimer says. Clayburgh's nomination of Quill evoked demands from the old-line San Antonio machine for intervention by Garner, a longtime ally. But the vice president, having lost one skirmish over the gentleman's contract, declined to participate in a second. And when the machine nonetheless persisted in its opposition, Brown remembers, Lyndon put on a first-class war. I mean he went all out, with all guns blazing, and got the appointment for Clayburgh's man. To cement Quill's allegiance to him, he got Quill's sister, Eloise, a job with the Department of Agriculture in Washington, and made a point of being in San Antonio on Saturdays, when Quill's mother, whom the postmaster adored, made cornbread and roast beef with brown gravy. That's what brought him out to the house a great deal, Quill says. He was very fond of her cooking. Had Johnson devised and promoted the gentleman's contract in anticipation of the San Antonio postmaster fight, because he already had his candidate for the job picked out? No one knows, Johnson never said. But the appointment that resulted from the contract was to prove important to Johnson over not only the long run. Quill would be his staunch ally in San Antonio for 35 years, but the short. An extravagant admirer of Lyndon Johnson, from the first time he met him, Quill says, he knew he was way above the average man of his age. He grasped things easily, and the political thing, he just took it over. Quill was immediately handling small but vital political favors for Johnson in San Antonio, and giving jobs to at least a few of Johnson's San Antonio friends. Johnson and Maverick became fast friends when Maury arrived to be sworn in. Shortly to enter a hospital for an operation to ease the effects of a crippling wound he had suffered in the Argonne, he could hardly walk, and Brown remembers him holding on to Johnson's arm for support as the two men walked from the Dodge to Child's for breakfast on New Year's Day. The friendship was based partly on Johnson's ability to talk as liberal with the liberal Maverick as he could talk conservative with his own conservative congressman. discussing a New Deal bill coming up in Congress, he would demand, "You're not going to throw down the president on this, are you?" Partly it was based on Maverick's admiration for what he had called Clayburgh's very efficient office setup. At his request, Johnson showed Maverick's secretary, Malcolm Bardwell, a newcomer to Washington, how to set up the 20th District office. Maverick autographed a photograph, "The Lyndon Johnson who got me started." And partly it was based on admiration for Johnson's political as well as secretarial skills. I remember Maury calling the office after he was in Congress, picking Johnson's brain, about legislation and what the effect of it was going to be and what the sentiment of the House was, Brown says. And Johnson cemented the friendship. Maury's younger brother, Albert, a resident of Clayburgh's 14th District, was given a coveted patronage post there. Johnson was only a congressional secretary, but he had influence now, influence on a level that most congressional secretaries never achieved, not just in one congressional district, but in two. And not just in two. Among the more popular of the rubber stamps provided by the office of the House stationery clerk was one that read, "Respectfully referred to blank." Most congressional offices routinely employed that stamp on all out-of-district requests. A staffer would smack the stamp down on the letter, fill in the name of the proper congressman to see, and drop the letter in the outfile. The normal man working for a congressman doesn't care about people living in other districts, Latimer points out. In the office of the 14th Congressional District of Texas, however, the use of that stamp was more selective. "We would not do what was normally done," Latimer says, "not if the person needing something was important, not if he knew other people who were important, not if he had money. If a person needing something was important, Johnson would work for him, and have his assistants work for him, no matter where he lived." More and more important businessmen needed something, specifically entree, in Washington, as government regulation of and participation in business escalated. They needed guidance through the immense jerry-built maze of bureaucratic regulation. They needed introduction to officials who could help them circumvent those regulations. They needed someone who could tell you whom you should see, and who could get you in to see him. Businessmen from Richard Clayburgh's district learned that his office could provide them with that entree. And because Johnson was making friends now not for Mr. Dick but for himself, the shrewder of them learned that it was not Mr. Dick who was providing it. Becoming exasperated over his inability to reach Clayburgh on the telephone, former Texas State Senator Alvin J. Wirtz, an attorney for a score of Nueces County clients, asked Russell Brown one day, "Do you suppose if I called the Burning Tree Golf Club, I could get our congressman?" The embarrassed Brown said, "Well, I just don't know where he is, Senator Wirtz." I know," Wirtz said with a grim chuckle. And then Brown recalls, Wirtz said, "Lyndon isn't there, is he?" And when Brown said no, Wirtz asked to have Johnson, not Clayburgh, call him back, and said, "I know he'll call me." And after that, Brown says, he stopped asking for Congressman Clayburgh. He always called for Lyndon. Johnson, of course, always did call back, and provided influential district residents not only with the assistance they requested, whether it was hard to obtain hotel reservations on their trips to Washington, or aid of a more significant nature, but also with assistance they had never thought of requesting. For example, a Corpus Christi businessman named Elmer Pope wanted introductions to the staff of the House Interstate Commerce Committee in connection with the bill that would provide federal aid for Corpus Christi. Johnson provided him with the introductions, and, unasked, with a detailed memorandum on the need for the legislation which Pope could present to the staffers. Attempting to impress these influential men with his entree and competence, to make them feel secure in his hands, he was careful not to let them realize what young and low-level hands they were. He tried never to let them see his living quarters. One prominent visitor from Texas who saw the Dodge basement, Welly Hopkins, was shocked. "They were living just like youngsters, like in a dormitory," he recalls. When they asked for hotel reservations, he provided them. As if it were easy for him to do so, they never suspected that because he possessed, in fact, no influence with hotels, he was often forced to frantically telephone one after another until he found a room. And sometimes, when he had been turned down everywhere to make a trip in person to see a reservation manager, spend his own money on a big tip. He never gave them even a hint of the difficulties he might encounter in attempting to secure interviews for them with high-ranking officials, difficulties which occurred frequently with officials who did not need Congressman Clayburgh's support on a pending bill, and who had never even heard of Congressman Clayburgh's secretary. His care was rewarded. Businessmen from the 14th District were as impressed as he could have wished. When businessmen from other Texas districts complained to them that their congressman couldn't provide much help with the Washington bureaucracy, they would suggest that they contact Dick Clayburgh's secretary. The newly formed Lower Colorado River Authority, for example, was planning to operate not in South, but in Central Texas. But its counsel was Alvin Wirtz, and he told the board members that it was to the 14th District office that the authority should look for help in Washington. The board member who accompanied Wirtz to Washington, Thomas C. Ferguson, saw that Wirtz was correct. Entree was vital to the LCRA, whose planned construction of a series of flood control dams required not only funding from the PWA, but permits from a dozen federal agencies. Provisions of the legislation under which the state of Texas had created the agency, moreover, made it necessary to obtain the funding and permits without delay. "We needed to see people quickly," Ferguson says. "We were pressed for time." Some of the officials they needed to see, Ferguson says, were high officials. One was Jerome N. Frank, then chief attorney of the Federal Power Commission. "And we couldn't get in to see them." Senator Wirtz said, "Let's go over to Clayburgh's office and see Lyndon. Maybe he can help." Ferguson was surprised to see how friendly the powerful Wirtz was with this young secretary. "They had a love fest there for a few minutes," Ferguson says. Then Wirtz told Johnson whom he needed to see. Johnson made an excuse not to call Frank and the other officials while Wirtz and Ferguson were present. He didn't want them to witness the shifts to which he would be put to arrange the appointments. When that night he telephoned the two Texans at their hotel, he simply told them the appointments had been arranged, as if it had been no trouble at all. And he created the image he had wanted to create. "Johnson called over there and got us in to see them real quick," Ferguson recalls. "He helped us a whole lot. Senator Wirtz was very much impressed, and so was I. He knew Washington. He could get you into any place." That was the word on Lyndon Johnson, that he knew Washington, that he could get you into any place. And now that word was beginning to circulate in wider and wider circles. It was beginning to be heard in conversations of wealthy and influential men across the length and breadth of Texas. John Garner, they said, was a good man to know in Washington. Certain senior and powerful Texas congressmen were good to know. Certain senior and powerful Texas lobbyists were good men to know. And so was a young man who was only a secretary to a congressman. More and more, in Houston and Lubbock and El Paso, businessmen who needed help in Washington were turning not to the offices of their own congressman, but to Dick Clayburgh's office and to Dick Clayburgh's secretary. Although he was the secretary for only one congressional district, he was creating an acquaintance, the kind of acquaintance that matters, in 20 congressional districts across the entire huge state. He was creating across that state more than an acquaintance. As the New Deal's new programs resulted in new bureaucracies, and as the bureaucracies swelled and swelled again, thousands of new federal jobs were created, jobs that could be filled with minimal reference to merit, since Congress, in approving the new agencies, had thoughtfully exempted many of them from civil service requirements. The choice jobs were out of the reach of Lyndon Johnson's congressman, junior and inactive as he was, not to mention the reach of his secretary. But the secretary secured quite a few jobs in the lower echelons. In government mailrooms, Gene Latimer was still working in the House post office, and now Latimer's best friend, his former Houston High classmate Carol Keach, was working in the mailroom of the Federal Housing Administration. And in government galleries, a rotating succession of young men served as doorkeepers in the House visitors' galleries. At the endless banks of desks in the Department of Agriculture's South Building, where Eloise Quill had been joined by several other young women from the 14th Congressional District of Texas, and in the immense federal warehouse on D Street Southwest that was the temporary headquarters of the Treasury Department's vastly expanded procurement division, where at least one of its 2,000 clerks, Ivan D. Bell, addressed Lyndon Johnson as chief, and in nooks and crannies of federal service ranging from library stacks on Capitol Hill Several Clayburgh constituents, including Johnson's oldest sister Rebecca, were researchers at the Library of Congress. To border crossing stations on the far-off Rio Grande, federal customs officers along the Mexican border came under Clayburgh's patronage, and by 1935, Latimer says, Johnson just about had the final say on who got hired to the Border Patrol and who got promotions. He had quite a few fans down there. He also plucked a few plums in Texas state agencies, for a telephone call from Roy Miller carried considerable weight in Austin. Low-ranking and low-paying, these jobs were nonetheless precious in the Depression to the persons for whom Johnson obtained them. They included fellow white stars who had graduated from the Teachers College at San Marcos, only to find teaching positions all but unavailable. Other young men from the Hill Country who had, against long odds, managed to put themselves through not only college but law school, only to find that hanging out a small-town shingle meant starvation, and that joining a big Houston law firm meant a salary of $75 per month. And other young men from the Hill Country who, without a college education, had been able to find no job at all. Lyndon didn't make you rich, says one of them, but he got you a job. Ben Crider, who had once loaned his young Johnson City friend money to help him stay in college, now received a $145 per month job as an appraiser with the Federal Land Bank's Houston office, and could hardly believe his luck. The best job I ever had, he exulted. They were very grateful. And they knew whom to be grateful to. Although the federal jobs were, as the phrase went, on the congressman's patronage, the people being placed in them were not the congressman's friends, but Lyndon Johnson's. Driven to Southwest Texas State Teachers College by his dread of spending his life on a farm, White Star Ernest Morgan was to find that the degree he had sacrificed so much to earn was no shield from that dread, for it could not get him a job. But Johnson could. I was very appreciative of what Lyndon Johnson did for me, Morgan says. Reinforcing the gratitude, in some cases, were self-interest and ambition. The ability of a contemporary young man with whom they had gone to school to distribute jobs reinforced their belief that he was going somewhere, somewhere up. And, says one of them, I had sense enough to tie on to him because I wanted to go up with him. Gratitude and other aspects of the quality he considered most important, the unquestioning obedience that he called loyalty, was, in fact, the prime qualification for a man receiving a Johnson job. Although one White Star recipient of a job, Horace Richards, possessed an independent cast of mind, all the others were men like little Wilton Woods, who had been willing to write editorials for Lyndon's signature and to date women for his designs. Fenner Roth, who had been willing to run his errands, and Willard Deason, who had, as his candidate for class president, served as his principal front man in his campaign to attain campus power. Men who had demonstrated at college a willingness to follow his leadership. Meeting them for the first time, L.E. Jones observed that they were all slow-talking, good-natured country boys, and that they shared another quality. All, he says, were yielding in nature, men willing to take orders. Some, in fact, now demonstrated that quality anew. Deason, for example, allowed Johnson to order his postgraduate life as he had allowed him to order his undergraduate life. He had been studying law at night while teaching in San Antonio's Alamo Heights High School. But when, in 1934, he obtained his law degree, school officials sort of halfway promised me the principalship if I stayed on. That prospect, with its prestige and its annual salary of more than $4,000, made him ecstatic. Johnson had obtained for him a summer job as a junior attorney with the Federal Land Bank's Houston branch, but dissatisfied both with the job, little more than a clerk, and its $125 per month salary, Deason was planning to return to Alamo Heights in September. Johnson, Deason recalls, said to me, "So you get to be a principal. What's that? If you're a lawyer, you can get ahead in the world." Johnson was very insistent that I stay at the Federal Land Bank. He stayed. Loyalty, the Johnson brand of loyalty, was the quality he looked for in new recruits, too. In determining whether or not it existed in a potential recruit with whom he had had no personal experience, he sometimes had to be guided by what he saw in a single meeting. But he had very sharp eyes. His relationship with these recruits over the years to come was to demonstrate that if Lyndon Johnson was not a reader of books, he was a reader of men, a reader with a rare ability to see into their souls. Nothing was to prove this more dramatically than his selection to receive the best job he had to give, a high-level administrative post with the State Department of Education, obtained through Roy Miller. For the man he chose was regarded by other men as a giver, not a taker of orders. The toughness, viciousness of slim, wiry Jesse Kellum was legendary in oil fields, where he had worked as a roustabout to earn college tuition, and on football fields. At San Marcos, from which he had graduated a year before Johnson arrived at the school, he had been a 140-pound fullback who scorned to wear a helmet, and who once deliberately broke an opponent's leg. On another occasion, when a huge opponent had persisted in illegally battering a 200-pound San Marcos tackle, Kellum had beaten him mercilessly until he could no longer rise, and then, standing over him, had said in his low, hard voice, "Now you quit beating on this little tackle of mine." The other quality for which he was known was leadership. Although he was the fullback, he called signals, and a teammate recalls, "In the huddle, Jesse spoke and we listened. He had command presence." But the reader of men had read Jesse Kellum. Despite his toughness and command presence, and a fierce, consuming ambition, when Lyndon Johnson met him for the first time in 1933, he was football coach in the dusty backwater town of Lufkin, Texas, earning little more than $100 per month. He had been stuck in that job for 8 years. At the age of 33, he had all but lost hope of ever finding a way out of the dead end his life seemed to have hit. Johnson arranged for him to get the state job. When the state superintendent of education attempted to renege on his promise to Roy Miller, Kellum, seeing his last hope disappearing, made a desperate telephone call to his young patron. Johnson was in Corpus Christi, but he jumped into his car and raced the 200 miles to Austin, and 200 back, that day to force the superintendent to deliver on the promise. For almost 40 years, starting a year or two thereafter, Jesse Kellum would work directly for Lyndon Johnson. Although he was the older by 8 years, he called Johnson Mr. Johnson. Johnson called him Jesse. Although Kellum liked giving orders, in a coldly domineering fashion, he made a point of never bestowing the courtesy of his full attention on a subordinate. When one was talking to him, his invariable, studied habit was never to stop shuffling through, and at least ostensibly reading, the papers on his desk. From one man he took orders, took them unquestioningly, with, in fact, a slavish obedience that, increasing over the years, eventually came to remind observers of Gene Latimer's. As the years passed and Kellum's powerful personality became submerged in a personality more powerful, his gratitude for a word of praise from his master would be almost painful to watch, almost as painful as his reaction to his master's anger. Latimer was not the only employee whom Johnson could make cry. What he said to Jesse Kellum behind the closed doors of his office is not known, but on more than one occasion, when the doors opened, Kellum, outwardly the toughest and most self-possessed of men, was to emerge with tears running down his hard face. In obtaining and filling patronage positions, Lyndon Johnson worked very hard. This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette.